Welcome, everyone, to a special episode of Conduct Detrimental. This week, I'm joined by Stephanie Weissenberger. What's up, Stephanie?
What's up, gang?
So later in this episode, we're going to be joined by the one, the only Dan Wallach, as well as our resident district attorney, Matt Timpanek. Before we get into the fun action, Steph, you listened to the last episode. Did you hear that Themis answered our prayers and actually sponsored the episode because of your little read? What do you think about that?
Oh, I heard and I was ecstatic. And then I, of course, got the follow from Themis on Twitter and Instagram and made my followers go up. So that was nice also. And that's a great way for anyone who's listening to get more information about Themis as a whole. Definitely reach out to them on their Instagram DMs, Twitter DMs, and give them a follow because they're always running deals. And I can tell you, Themis is the best in the business.
Okay, Stephanie, relax. Okay, they're obviously the best, but like, you know, don't overdo it, okay? They were happy enough with our last episode. We had a world of a lot of fun. People were very proud that we got our first sponsor. And you know what? Shout out to Themis for pulling it off. We appreciate all the shouts and all the loves, obviously from Themis. Appreciate having our first sponsor, and everyone was very nice that we got our sponsor. So that said, we have some issues to address. We have a very big episode today. We have Bill Shaken from the Los Angeles Times joining us. He's their baseball staff writer. Big get for Conduct Detrimental. He's a friend of the show via Ben Mycelis in our office, you know, who's worked with Bill on a number of his cases. He's also just a fan of my firm, Garagos & Garagos, from the LA scene. So, and your firm too, Steph. We should say that you started with the firm this past week.
That's true, I guess. I'm still waiting to hear if I pass, but, you know, with Themis, I'm hoping that I did.
We're going to have Matt and Dan join us after Bill, but for now, we will turn it over to Bill Shaken of the Los Angeles Times. Bill, welcome to Conduct Detrimental. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
We're good. We're good. So, you know, we thought you'd be a great guest for the podcast, obviously being the baseball staff writer at the LA Times, this Trevor Bauer case. I see you and your colleagues all over it. What we wanted to have you talk a little bit about on the show today is kind of the mechanisms of baseball, baseball's legal process, how the domestic violence policy is kind of coming to gear. And, you know, well, this $100 million question, what's going on with Trevor Bauer's contract? But I guess, you know, before we jump in, do you have kind of overall thoughts on baseball's handling of this, Dodgers' handling of this?
Well, in terms of baseball's handling, it's prescribed by a domestic violence policy that was collectively negotiated with the Players Association. So I think a lot of fans who may not be familiar with the situation or, you know, grabbing pitchforks and the Dodgers should do this, or on the other side, oh, Bauer's getting reamed or what have you. But again, it's a collectively negotiated agreement. The Dodgers can't do anything independent of that agreement at this point. Certainly Bauer has full legal representation. And so the process will play out, and the domestic violence policy prescribes what happens in Major League Baseball once a player is alleged to have committed domestic abuse or sexual assault.
On the DV policy, I think I'm seeing kind of some misinformation on both sides. Truthfully, and I read your article, and I'm make sure I send it out, but you had a Q&A just kind of talking about what the ramifications of Bauer's deal was, and you pointed out a 2004 incident involving Denny Neagle, who I remembered from the Colorado Rockies back in the day. I mean, that was an incident where a contract was voided. So in our sports landscape, which we'll get into separately, but we have the Deshaun Watson situation, we have the Trevor Bauer situation. There aren't many situations in baseball. That's why I think you had to go back to 2004 to find one where a contract is voided based on some conduct that occurs off the field. So can you kind of speak a little bit about the research that you found and maybe this old Denny Neagle case to kind of guide us?
So the premise in baseball is that player contracts are fully guaranteed. There may be options, there may be incentives, but the base salary is fully guaranteed. So unlike in the NFL where, you know, if you have an injury that might end your career and that might also end most of your contract, that's not the case in baseball. If I sign for, you know, $10 million, I wish, and my arm blows out tomorrow, I still get the $10 million. So in Bauer's case, he has $102 million guaranteed by the Dodgers. And if the Dodgers wish to get out of that contract, there's not a whole lot they can do. What they can do right now is be quiet, let the disciplinary process play out. And assuming that Bauer gets suspended by Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, which I think is almost certain, that suspension would be unpaid. Right now, Bauer is on what they call administrative leave that allows the player to be off the field while the investigations continue. Administrative leave is paid. So for now, Bauer is getting his salary. And then again, that's part of a collectively negotiated process. It doesn't really matter how frustrated the Dodgers are that they really need pitching and this guy's unavailable. That's just how it works. Major League Baseball will wrap up its investigation. And they'll levy, again, I assume what will be a fairly long suspension. That will be unpaid. And at the end of that process, the Dodgers have to figure out what to do. Now, they could try to say, you know, the standard player contract says, and I don't have the exact language in front of me at this second, but essentially conduct unbecoming of the team. And
Or you could say conduct detrimental. But
you could say that. In fact, you should. But anything that, you know, puts the team in a bad light could void the contract. And I think the example you mentioned is instructive, the Denny Nagel case. In 2004, Nagel was found by police officers in Colorado soliciting a prostitute. It went through the legal process. But even before the legal process was over, the Rockies had had enough of Denny Nagel. They didn't like that incident. There was a previous incident. It wasn't prostitution, but it was something else. And so the Rockies just said, we don't want this guy on our team anymore. They cut him and they said, we're not going to pay you. So because Major League Baseball has a strong players union, there's a grievance process. And Nagel and the union filed a grievance and said, doesn't really matter whether you like me or you don't like me, you got to pay me. It's guaranteed. And they reached a settlement for not 100% of the money that Nagel was owed, but pretty close to it. So I would imagine if the Dodgers want to cut bait with Bauer after he serves an unpaid suspension and say, we want to at least try to recover some of our money, they can. And that would put the onus on Bauer and the union to file a grievance.
Here's really where my last question is. I'll turn it over to Stephanie, and I'm sure I'll have some more. There is a world right now, and the listeners of the podcast know I used to work for the New York Giants public relations department. If you are in the Los Angeles Dodgers public relations department, you're dealing with a nightmare, and you can't really do anything about it, right? Because it's not even at a point where there's a suspension that's issued. You're still in the investigatory phase. So from our standpoint as, you know, baseball fans and lawyers, what's going on now, and I know your colleagues over at the LA Times are covering very closely, we are learning more facts with each day. That's going to push the investigation further out because you're still learning more and more information. So is there any world where Los Angeles Dodgers, as a PR standpoint, they go, you know what? We want to make a stand right now. We want to cut him today. Pre-investigation conclusion, pre-suspension. Is that something that the Dodgers are allowed to do as it currently stands?
My understanding is they are not. They are subject to that collectively bargained domestic violence policy that we discussed. And in that policy, it says that once Major League Baseball launches an investigation, which of course they have of Bauer, that the commissioner's office retains sole disciplinary authority. It's not up to the Dodgers to do what they want. It's up to the league. So at this point, there's nothing the Dodgers can do. And as you mentioned, it might be frustrating for them, but that is the policy under which they do have to abide. There's one exception. Essentially, right now, Bauer, as we discussed, is getting paid while the league investigates. At some point, whenever the league is finished investigating, or at least whenever it believes it has enough evidence for the suspension that I think will almost certainly happen, Manfred can levy his suspension. But things are taking a while. There's a court process right now. There could be another court process if charges are filed. But if we get to the end of this week, and this is the week of the hearing on the restraining order, and if the judge rules by the end of the week, then the restraining order process is done. Whether there is a restraining order going forward or there is not, the process is over. And if the DA still has not filed charges against Bauer or even decided whether to file charges, then there's really no legal proceedings that Bauer would be involved in at that point. The TRO is done. Nothing's happened on the criminal charges front. So at that point, the union, which represents Bauer, of course, could say to Major League Baseball, these extensions of his leave that we've been giving you roughly every week so that you can do your investigation, we don't really want to give them to you anymore because he's not under any legal proceeding right now. I understand why you wanted to wait to hear the information from the temporary restraining order hearing, but that's over. Now, the union and Bauer could get together and say, you know what? Probably is best to just keep accepting these extensions of administrative leave. Bauer gets paid for the moment. But if, for whatever reason, Bauer and the union decide, you know what? There's nothing going on criminally. We don't know if Bauer's ever getting charged. Let's get him back on the field. Well, Manfred would have a couple of options. Normally his option would be, okay, well, I'm going to put you on suspension on my own accord then. And that's because you're involved in a criminal or legal proceeding. But now he might not be as of next week. So if Bauer and the union, you know what, we're not doing any more extensions, then Manfred could do a couple things. One is he could suspend Bauer based on whatever evidence they have. And that's, I think, why this week is particularly crucial, because Major League Baseball doesn't have the governmental powers that, you know, law enforcement agencies or courts do. So Major League Baseball gets the benefit of what's happening in the California courts this week, and will have that for all of its evidence to consider. But the risk baseball runs is to say, well, we could suspend it based on what we know now, but what if we find out more stuff later, right? The Washington Post just had a story the other day on one other woman who had alleged Bauer had had a similar behavioral issue with her. So the wild card is that there is a clause in the policy, domestic violence policy, that says at any point, the commissioner can transfer the authority to discipline Bauer back to the team. And if Bauer and his legal team say, we're not consenting to any more extensions, Manfred could say, fine, I'll just transfer the authority back to the Dodgers. At that point, maybe they'll just cut you and you can go fight for your money.
Now, so I know that you mentioned that obviously the contracts are fully guaranteed. So what does that kind of have to do with the morals clauses that are then inserted in these contracts? Is there any way that the Dodgers can get out of paying the full money left on this contract? Or is it kind of just going to be a similar situation to the Colorado Rockies player, Danny Nagel, who then had to file a grievance against the team to try and get the rest of his contract?
It's a good question. The case law, if you will, is so rare in that area that when you go back and look at precedent, there's not much. And that's why we talked about the Nagel. We don't know, and I should clarify this, if there is language specific to Bauer's contract. So we're just talking about the language from the standard player contract. But assuming that language is in Bauer's contract or language similar, the Dodgers certainly can make every effort to make that case and say, look, I mean, what more do we have to do? Here's the testimony from the restraining order hearing. And this isn't behavior that we think is representative of what our players should be doing. And they can make that case to an arbitrator. Unfortunately, the most recent precedent is the Nagel case, where the Rockies did that, and they still had to pay almost 100% of the salary.
I think, Bill, you mentioned this is why we keep saying there's more facts coming out. So people can say, what's taking baseball so long? I think there's some indication they might have known about this Washington Post story. I think that I saw that in the Washington Post article, that MLB was aware of this earlier incident. Now, I saw some news yesterday that the Dodgers were not aware of this earlier incident prior to signing Trevor Bauer. So there are some incidents, you know, in contract law, I imagine it's the case in baseball, especially with an injury. You have an affirmative obligation to disclose if there is some type of, I don't know, condition that might keep you off the field from an injury perspective. Is there any world where the Dodgers could seek relief for Trevor Bauer's failure to tell them about this older Indians incident? Is that anything that you're hearing?
I would find that hard to believe, and I don't have a JD, so I should probably defer to you guys on that. But you'd look and say, well, what would he have told? Was I charged with anything? No. Was I convicted of anything? No. Was there a restraining order? Briefly, but it was dropped. I'm not sure what the liability there would be.
Yeah. You know, it's funny from a baseball perspective, you know, and I don't know the answer to that. That's why we have to ask questions as lawyers, yeah, and we can figure it out. But I remember, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it, AJ Preller situation when, you know, when he was just starting out with the Padres. He was trading guys that had kind of undisclosed medical conditions. There was like one file for like the medical conditions we're okay telling teams about, and there was the other file that was like, yeah, we're going to hide these medical conditions, at least as the allegations were. I imagine, right, and I haven't seen it, I haven't seen the Indians comment on this, but I imagine this came across the Indians' radar back in 2017. This was a restraining order that I think was filed in 2020. Trevor Bauer has popped around a couple teams in that time frame. So is it possible that multiple teams knew about this, right? I know there was a big sweepstakes to sign Bauer in the offseason. Is it possible other teams found out about it? I do find it odd that the Dodgers are saying we did not know about it, when if you're doing your homework, maybe this is something that comes up. When you get to this grievance stage, and I know, Bill, I spoke to you offline, there was a fight once upon a time with Michael Vick, obviously a different sport, in the Atlanta Falcons, kind of fighting back for some of this money. You know, you have a grievance procedure. I think it's possible that Bauer gets the lion's share of his money, but this is a 3-year, $100 million deal. it's a ton of money that the Dodgers would be on the hook for. So I think normally, right, like in a baseball situation, you might say, hey, cut the guy and we'll deal with it later. I know Starlin Castro is dealing with the situation. I know Domingo Germán has dealt with something like that. Aroldis Chapman, Marcell Ozuna. But the guaranteed money in baseball, maybe this is the case where we find something that can really give the team an out. You know, the Dodgers lawyers, I'm sure, are looking for it. But short of kind of citing to Denny Nagel, is there any other way that you see the Dodgers getting out from under the weight of this $100 million contract?
I think it'll be a great test case. I mean, you go and see what the arbitrator has to say. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, it's not a court case. It's limited to baseball's arbitration system. So they'll have to look at the precedents from the sport and not maybe what happened in other sports or other situations. And, you know, I know you talked about the Ohio incident with Bauer, and the Post story made pretty clear that those records had been either closed or expunged. I'm not sure which. So, you know, even if somebody did a criminal scrub, I'm not sure that that would have shown up. You know, there is, you talked about Preller and the Padres sort of obfuscating about medical records, and there's issues in baseball that baseball can resolve within. And in the case of, you know, everybody's favorite villains, the Houston Astros, you know, they got disciplined within the system of baseball, but there are fans and players that have gone to court and said they essentially were cheated of what they were owed under their fair contracts. And they've gotten nowhere in court with that. It's been pretty much a baseball matter. And I would suspect because there's collective bargaining agreement, any court would defer to that agreement and say whatever discipline does or does not come, and however Bauer's contract is or is not resolved, that's collectively negotiated between the players and the union, and the court would not get involved.
Stephanie, I'm going to tee you up. Bill, Stephanie is, you know, she's like our social media superstar here. I don't know if this was your reporting, but I know I've seen it. There were some reports that the Dodgers players have started to unfollow Trevor Bauer on various forms of social media. So, Steph, I'll turn it to you. I think this is maybe where Bill might, maybe he has some insight, but he obviously is the baseball staff writer for the Times.
Yeah, I mean, because it's definitely one thing for the Dodgers organization as a whole. I know they canceled the Trevor Bauer bobblehead night, for example. But I think a different side to the story is whether, you know, his teammates are even going to support him if and when he does come back, regardless of how much of a star pitcher he is, if they're already unfollowing him on social media. And I mean, to me, that seems like they don't want him to come back because of everything that's happened. So do you have any insight on, you know, maybe any rumblings that you've heard in the LA community or how LA fans are even feeling about this?
I think the tough thing for us as baseball writers this year is because of COVID protocols, we don't get to go in the clubhouse every day. And that is usually the place where, you know, you stand next to a guy's locker, you chat for a couple minutes, get a feel of the pulse of the clubhouse, doesn't have to have every conversation be on the record. But yeah, there is certainly an undercurrent of dissatisfaction among some of the players. And, you know, they're professionals. And I'm sure if he came back that they would figure out a way to deal with it. But, you know, they've got the second best record in baseball without him. It's not as if this guy is keeping them from, you know, winning the World Series or something like that. They're still a pretty darn good team. So I think people want results. And there was a guy the Dodgers had, you know, a while back, Yasiel Puig, an outfielder who was very talented and also somewhat controversial. And, you know, when he was available every day and when he was hitting 300 with 30 home runs, the players loved him. And, you know, when he was hitting 200 and his attitude became an issue, they didn't love him so much. And, you know, I mean, here's a team in an unexpected pennant race. I don't think the Dodgers expected to be looking up at the San Francisco Giants and the standings, and you know, Bauer is not available to help them.
Wild horse, I remember, as was the initial call for Puig. But, you know, I think we'll get you out on this, Bill, just so everyone's clear. And Billy, I don't want to bury this. There's no civil lawsuit against Trevor Bauer at this point in time. There was one, I believe, that was drafted but never filed in that old Cleveland Indians, Ohio case. There's no criminal charges that are filed against Trevor Bauer. I can say this, Bill, you don't have to. The fact that there are no criminal charges at this point, despite, you know, all the cards being laid on the table, is sometimes an indication that there will be no criminal charges. Now, the bombshell over the weekend was the one that, you know, the baseball world had to pay attention to. An older incident from 2017 that has some similarities to the current incident, right? And these two alleged accusers apparently have no connection to one another. It's different cities, years apart. Do you think that this earlier incident will have some bearing on whether Trevor Bauer or not is suspended by Major League Baseball?
The league is certainly aware of it and has been looking into it. So I can't imagine they wouldn't take it into consideration. I guess the main point I would leave your listeners with, if I had one, is that we could get to the end of this restraining order hearing and we could get to a decision by the DA not to press charges if there is going to be that decision. And Bauer could still get a lengthy suspension from Major League Baseball. And I think a lot of fans would say, well, that doesn't really add up. He's not getting charged, so why is he getting suspended? And the answer, of course, is that in criminal court, the standard, as you guys know, is beyond a reasonable doubt. And people can watch the accounts of the restraining order hearing this week and maybe come to whatever conclusions they do. And maybe they think it's beyond a reasonable doubt and maybe they don't. But under baseball's collectively negotiated domestic violence policy, there is no such standard. The commissioner has the authority. They do work closely with the Players Association, because if you read the policy, you'll notice that unlike, say, a player testing positive for steroids, it's a certain number of games. There is no gray area. The players union and the commissioner usually negotiate the lengths of these suspensions, try to fit them to whatever facts they've been able to uncover, and generally try to do it because they don't want the union to file a grievance about it. And they've been very, very successful in that. And again, the underlying point there is that there does not need to be a criminal conviction. There does not even need to be a criminal charge. Major League Baseball does its own investigation. And if the commissioner believes the behavior is worthy of suspension because it falls short of the domestic violence standard outlined in the policy, there'll be a suspension coming. And like I said, I would be stunned if there isn't a long one coming for Mr. Bauer.
Bill, we thank you so much for joining Conduct Detrimental. You are off the hot seat. I did not rub in the fact that my San Francisco Giants are in first place. Oh, wait, I just did. And
I brought it up first.
I wasn't going to say it. This is in safe zone. Yeah. But all good, Bill. We really appreciate your time. And listen, if this case continues to progress where it is, people should follow Bill's colleague, Steve Henson, at the LA Times. He's seemingly in the room giving us updates on the fly. So between Bill and Steve, you have some really good coverage on this this case that's at the forefront of all things sports law. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it. So that was Bill Shaikin of the Los Angeles Times. You can find Bill on Twitter at Bill Shaikin, S-H-A-I-K-I-N. Steph, what'd you think?
I mean, I think Bill was absolutely fantastic, and he was able to explain, you know, the burdens of proof and just the criminal law side of things, which did give me some flashbacks to my time with Themis in the criminal law realm. Flashcards online. It definitely gave me some flashbacks to Themis. So shout out Themis. Love Themis.
Steph, you know you're not getting paid for the amount of times we mentioned Themis, right? That's not.
I know. I just love it so much.
Well, listen, Bill was fantastic. Bill has a colleague, Steve Henson, who's in the courtroom over in the Trevor Bauer hearing. So I'm following his colleague, Steve Henson, very closely. But yeah, this is obviously a very serious case. You know, it kind of takes us to the second part of our episode. Steph, you're going to be leaving us. Dan Wallach, Matt Timpanak are going to be joining us. We're going to talk about Trevor Bauer saga, what we've learned from the hearings. And then we're going to get into Deshaun Watson. That's going to be it. Steph, thanks so much for joining us. And I'll see you in the office.
Sounds good. See you then.
As promised, our second part of the podcast, Dan Wallach joins us. And a special second guest, Dan, who do we have?
Well, joining us today as our second guest is somebody I got to know on Twitter about a year ago during the DeAndre Baker, you know, criminal legal proceedings in Broward County. And I was tweeting an awful lot about the case. And a lawyer by the name of Matt Timpanak jumped into my timeline quite a bit to sort of engage me in a dialogue about the case. And Matt seemed to know what he was talking about because he's a former felony prosecutor in the state of Florida. And as we've gotten to know him over the past year, he's written several articles, he's written an article about the Bauer case for Conduct Detrimental. I thought he'd be the perfect guest to kind of walk us through this week's hearing involving Trevor Bauer and the kind of criminal jeopardy that Trevor Bauer faces with regard to these allegations of sexual misconduct and sexual assault. So joining us is former felony prosecutor from the state of Florida's 12th Judicial Circuit and a litigator at the statewide law firm of Wicker Smith in Florida. Matt, welcome. It's your debut on Conduct Detrimental. Great to have you.
Great to be here today, guys. I'm happy to be on and speak with you about Bauer and Deshaun Watson.
All right, let me just get really elemental here. There is no chance that Trevor Bauer ever wants to see his accuser again. They are never going to have a relationship. It's over. She's accused him of the worst conduct. They will have no contact with one another. Why is it necessary to have a formal TRO hearing when the parties will probably never want to deal with each other ever again? And why wouldn't Trevor Bauer just consent to a permanent TRO if he has no interest in continuing any kind of involvement with this person? What's the upside and the downside to this? And why are they doing it this way?
Well, they're doing it this way for two reasons. The first and foremost is the victim wants to have this matter litigated. She wants a permanent restraining order from him. That is key because the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office and the Pasadena Police Department are watching this very closely. This hearing gives those offices an ability to see how the victim's going to hold up on the stand, how the evidence they have currently is adjudicated by a judge, and to see what Bauer's attorneys are going to be arguing. As I stated in an article I wrote for Conduct Detrimental last week, the trial before the trial, this is a case where the entire case, as it stands right now, can be litigated before it ever charges or ever filed. Because if the restraining order isn't granted, I think it's a real possibility that the district attorney's office and the police department decline charges. Because if, based on what they have right now, a judge doesn't think it's enough in a civil standard, which is far lower than a criminal standard, I think they'd end up declining to file the charges.
Couldn't he have just consented to a permanent TRO and be done with it without having to face cross-examination and the potential for having his testimony be fodder for a criminal case and a civil lawsuit? Why not just consent to a TRO and be done with it?
Because you want to be able to attack the victim and for the DA's office to be scared to actually file these charges. You have a victim. She doesn't present well. She has to answer a lot of questions she probably doesn't want to answer. And if she doesn't do well, case could get dismissed against her. If he consents to it, just, all right, fine, whatever, no TRO. He is almost guaranteeing that they'll move forward with charges. Like, okay, he's not even trying to fight this. At this hearing, he will be called to testify. However, as I've read in other outlets, I think the LA Times, he's going to invoke his right to remain silent and not answer any of the questions.
Matt, a couple things. What I find fascinating here, and maybe this is specific to California, this is why we wanted to have you on. I mean, I think in New York, in order to have some type of restraining order application, you need to meet the criterion of a specific charge, right? If it's harassment or if it's, you know, assault, there has to be some type of charge met here. Now, you would know this based on your background as a district attorney. The fact that there are no criminal charges yet, was it possible that the district attorney could have already filed charges, or do they procedurally kind of have to wait until the restraining order is over? I'm still trying to figure that part out.
Well, the key with this case is that he hasn't been already arrested. My thinking, a lot of people have been talking about why hasn't he been arrested. Usually in domestic violence cases, you get a complaint from a victim and you are like, I found probable cause to arrest him, and they go and arrest him. But since this is going to be such a high profile case, there's no reason to arrest him right now until this matter with the civil hearing is first adjudicated. The thinking being is the moment they put the cuffs on him and arresting him, they start clocks like speedy trial. Sometimes you have to file charges within a certain amount of time. He has to be tried within a certain amount of time. All of those things, they're in no rush to do. He's not going anywhere. They can arrest him any time, but they probably, my belief is they want all their ducks in a row. As seen, Trevor Bauer has highly paid, successful criminal defense lawyers representing him in this civil hearing. I can't even imagine what he would have at a trial. It sounds like they have, I think what I read yesterday is that there has been mountains of discovery just for this civil hearing. Now put it on top that you have probably one of the biggest trials, I don't know, since what, Aaron Hernandez? And if you don't have it all together, potentially, I don't know when the district attorney is up for re-election. It could be as early as 2022. You do not want a high profile defeat. And you need to have it all together before you arrest him, and you need to have it cold.
Let me ask you this part, and then I want to kind of get into the testimony, but this is kind of more of my overarching question, right? The facts here appear to be two incidents, you know, and then obviously some back and forth texting. My understanding of what a restraining order would require is that you represent some type of danger to the alleged victim. Now, if you have kind of an isolated incident or two isolated incidents, that's not necessarily going to be cause to have a valid, you know, permanent order of protection put in place. Isn't the real question here what Trevor Bauer's intentions are moving forward, right? Doesn't the order of protection look ahead and try to predict if someone's going to act bad again? I don't know if we have any evidence of that. Why aren't we talking about that part of the case?
because where we're at is the civil restraining hearing. Under California's Domestic Violence Protection Act, in order to get a permanent restraining order, well, California's case, it'll be a 5-year restraining order. The victim petitioner, who is the victim in this case, must show sufficient evidence. Now, this is to the satisfaction of the court, a past act or acts of abuse. So I think I read somewhere that Bauer's attorney was saying that it was, oh, this is intended to prevent future harm. Correct. But past behavior in some cases can be used as a guide to prevent future behavior. So he's done this in the past. The act is trying to prevent it in the future.
Matt, let's talk about Trevor Bauer going on the stand. He faces, you know, real risks here by testifying, you know, truthfully on the stand that the fruits of his testimony could end up being used in this in the criminal case and the civil case against him, depending on how badly it goes. Why would he want to testify, and how important is demonstrating or at least testifying on the issue of consent? How important is that to what the plaintiff has to prove here? Can you go through the thought process behind why he would or would not want to testify?
The reason he would want to try to testify is it would likely be against the advice of his counsel. He'd want it so that his side of the story is told. In a vast majority of domestic violence cases, alleged, the defendant always wants to tell his side of the story. It's usually up to his attorney to be like, no, you don't have to take the stand. You don't have to say anything incriminating. And the last thing you want to do is take the stand and decide to answer truthfully the questions. And those questions and your responses are used against you in a future criminal trial. The worst witness you would want to have in the state of California versus Trevor Bauer is Trevor Bauer testifying against himself. That is compelling evidence. These proceedings are recorded by a court reporter, and you don't want anything that a jury could hear to come out in this proceeding. This is not the whole ball game. If this restraining order is granted, that doesn't guarantee charges are filed at all. Why would you give the prosecution any more than they already have, especially evidence that is admissible at trial? On the other side of the coin, what he's saying to probably his attorneys, isn't my silence make me guilty? As you saw with that Twitter rant on Saturdays, like where he had the Ohio woman from the 2020 incidents, like I admitted to being in a consensual relationship with her from 2016 to 2019. That was a real mistake on his part, because he is essentially now admitted that he had a relationship with that woman. It could have easily, he says nothing, and it could have been lost in translation, lost in everything that's being reported. But now he has admitted that this girl and her were intimately related. And the prosecution, I can guarantee you, is going to interview that woman.
Matt, let me jump in for a second. So you said a couple things that we got to address. So number one, this Cleveland incident, just so people that are coming to this anew, Washington Post reported over the weekend that in 2017, Bauer had some type of a relationship with someone that lived in Ohio. He was a member of the Cleveland Indians. An incident occurred in 2017. The police were called. This alleged accuser was under 21, but was of legal age of consent. So some age between 18 and 21. And police found her. She was alleging, you know, that she had photos in her phone, that Bauer hit her, that she had blood in her eyes, bruising. But, you know, the police kind of inconspicuously ended up arresting her for underage drinking. And that case, you know, I don't know if it necessarily progressed, but that's where it was. The next 3 years are largely filled with Trevor Bauer sending kind of these gross text messages, you know, and I posted them online. I've redacted some of the more upsetting and disturbing words, but allegations that Bauer kind of was harassing her on Snapchat, maybe borderline threatening to kill somebody, you know, describing in graphic detail what he wanted to do to someone. And I think he used the term allegedly, right? Allegedly what whoever's sending these texts to, you know, assuming they're real, to kick her out and, you know, to knock her out, and then to potentially send a video of these acts to a family member. So these are some really dark messages that are purportedly coming from Bauer to this alleged accuser. We can talk about the mistakes that were made. Now, we're only talking about a restraining order for the Dodgers case. I know in your article that you wrote for conductdetrimental.com, you spoke about how these materials could potentially come out as habit evidence to the extent that there was a criminal prosecution pertaining to this Dodgers case. Is there any world where this Indians evidence, these Snapchats and these texts from this 2017 incident, that they can come in the order of protection? Or is that possible that they come up here?
it's possible. To be able to present that, they'd have to first authenticate them. And they'd have to call that woman as a witness, because if they call Trevor Bauer, he's not going to testify about this. I think that it's more likely that in a prospective criminal trial, that evidence may be admitted because it does show some kind of pattern. I actually am in the process of writing another article, a teaser, if it were, about the issues with that 2020 incident, the controlled call, because consent has become a huge issue. I'll obviously get into more of that in the article, but obviously find the article on conduct detrimental in the next day or so.
Matt, can a single incident, can one incident be a habit? I mean, I wasn't a prosecutor and I dealt with evidentiary issues in the context of civil lawsuits, but isn't like a habit for purposes of admissibility something that's part of a pattern and practice, meaning multiple incidents bearing similar characteristics? Can one incident like this from 2020 be characterized as a habit for purposes of its admissibility? And if so, why? Then that would open the door to any prior act being admissible as a habit if it showed some similarities.
Well, with this incident, what we have in the 2020 incident is Trevor Bauer allegedly choked this woman unconscious to the point she could not breathe and continued to have sex with her. That is strikingly similar to the allegations in the 2021 incident, where, as reported in various outlets, Trevor Bauer was allegedly engaging in allegedly consensual sexual intercourse, and at one time proceeded to choke the victim with her own hair unconscious, and then continued to have sex with her. So when you have that, and additionally, the punching aspect, both women say that Trevor Bauer punched them hard and repeatedly, and neither of them allegedly gave him consent to do either. So it doesn't need to be like in the Watson case, where you have 22 different women that he did the same thing each time. Habit evidence could be he did it one other time and this time. I had a case when I was still a prosecutor for fleeing to elude, and I wanted to introduce the second fleeing to elude he had done, where the same facts, where he was pulled over for law enforcement for speeding. They came up to him, he gave them their ID, and he drove away. He did that twice with the same ID, and I wanted to introduce the one that hadn't been adjudicated yet, so the jury could say to prove identity, because his issue was, when dealing with habit evidence, usually, almost always, it is admissible to eliminate any doubt as to identity or knowledge. How I think it might come into evidence, the 2020 incident, is that he had knowledge that what he was doing caused the alleged victim in the 2020 incident to be rendered unconscious. Because in one of the charges that I think he could be charged with is rape of an unconscious person. And one of the essential elements that the prosecution has to prove is that the defendant knew she was unconscious and still continued to have sex with that individual. And I think that's what you have here, allegedly.
This is where it's a kind of a dark allegation, but this is where, and you mentioned it, I want to make sure we hit this. I've been very clear, and this is why this question is the reason we wanted to have you on the show. People can be into all sorts of weird stuff. I know there's a whole community out there into some weird stuff that maybe not everyone is okay with, but there's a community that can do that, right? It's a community that's into, we'll say, you know, like Trevor Bauer is saying, like that this alleged accuser in 2021, she liked it rough, right? There's a community that's into that. There is a different definition of consent between two adult individuals, a consent that will be upheld by a court of law. So Matt, I'm going to give you a hypothetical, and then we'll kind of get into the lawyer's response here. If there was a text, which I'm not aware of if there being a text, and maybe we'll find on a cross-examination if this occurred, but if there was a text or some question at some point, and the alleged accuser went to Bauer and said, Trevor, you know what I like? I like when I get knocked unconscious, completely out cold. And then I like when, you know, someone does something to me while I'm unconscious. And there's a text that says that. And they submit that as proof. Look, she consented to it. Does Bauer win the case? Does Bauer get off on that text? Is that smoking gun?
You guys just figured out my article. So what I am writing, it's called advanced consent, which means that, hey, I'm okay with you doing all this and choking me unconscious. The truth of the matter, under California case law, under People v. Dancy, an individual, a victim who is rendered unconscious cannot continue to consent to the consensual act, because the defendant has rendered, even for a mere moment, that victim's ability to decide whether or not she wanted to continue. Think about it like this. In the Bauer case, what we know from the alleged facts, they were having consensual sex and he choked her with her hair and rendered her unconscious. That act itself, when she was unconscious for 3, 4, 5 seconds,
because she has no legal capacity. It's not possible.
And that is where the consent argument goes out the window. For those moments that she was unconscious, she was unable to consent. And by definition, she was unable to consent. And he took that ability from her. Even if she said, I'm good with all this stuff, it doesn't matter. Text messages said one thing. The law in California says another.
I'm with you. There's certainly some striking similarities between the two. It was a mistake, at least in my vantage point, that was made on the 2021. I'm just going to call it the Dodgers case, a little bit easier for me. But on the Dodgers case, the response by Bauer's attorney essentially said that any physicality between them was purely consensual. I remember, you know, and paraphrasing, but that was a little bit the response, that any physicality between them was consensual. And then you go back, right? Go back to the Indians case, the one from 2017, the one where the restraining order was filed in 2020. And there, you know, these comments, Matt, that you read, obviously these are all alleged, right? We don't really know if Bauer actually sent these Snapchat messages, but we know in 2017, you know, the accuser claimed that Bauer sent these. And there was a back and forth between the attorneys for Bauer and for this accuser, where not every message, the authenticity was questioned. Some, the authenticity wasn't questioned by Bauer's team. Instead, what was pointed out was the response by the accuser, hey, that she was into this, or there's some indication of consent. So, you know, always the authenticity can be questioned, but I think Bauer's attorneys made another misstep in the earlier case by basically acknowledging, hey, these things are legit, but, you know, essentially, she was into it too. I don't think that helps the case on either front. It removes one key element of authenticity, which could be a really, you know, heavy evidentiary battle before the case. And now, you know, seemingly they acknowledge it in the court of public opinion. And Matt, this is kind of my, you know, leading to my last question on the Bauer stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff that is not going to come into court, right? I think we're on the same page. I don't necessarily think that these Ohio stuff's going to come in on this Dodgers case. It might not even come in, you know, on the prejudicial versus probative analysis might not come in. And, you know, Major League Baseball is not a court of law. Major League Baseball is going to render a suspension based on what's in the public sphere, not necessarily what comes into a court. You know, I know you're not a, you know, Rob Manfred, not the commissioner of Major League Baseball. So let me ask you as a DA, I'm sure Rob Manfred's going to be consulting with some legal people. I know in the NFL's legal office, they have a lot of people that are associated with the DA's office. Do you think there's any world where Trevor Bauer avoids a suspension for what we know in the vernacular so far, what the allegations being put out are?
No, I really think it's unlikely at best. I think that the allegations are so severe. The photographs speak for themselves. And you have a all-star pitcher, the former Cy Young Award winner, somebody who would be a Cy Young contender this year and a potential World Series contender this year. And you're going to put that guy out in the mound in October where everybody's talking about, do you remember what happened just a few months ago? Wasn't he allegedly done this? I think that MLB is going to be of the opinion that this guy shouldn't be playing. Regardless of what was consensual and what wasn't consensual, he still beat her repeatedly, allegedly. Those photographs speak for themselves, and it's just too steep of a hill of a climb.
Yeah, I think the MLB suspension is preordained. I mean, the Major League Baseball is basically waiting for the, you know, testimony to come out, a little bit more judicial proceedings before they drop the hammer. I mean, they want to have some appearance of deciding this objectively, but the standard for imposing discipline under professional sports collective bargaining agreements is not a preponderance of the evidence. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a sliver or substantial or credible evidence. It's a very low evidentiary threshold. And you know that Major League Baseball, from an optics perspective, and the Dodgers from a contractual perspective, they want to wash their hands with this guy and not have him represent either the team or Major League Baseball at any time in the future. Is that fair? Is that legal? Will it be subject to an arbitration proceeding somewhere down the road? Perhaps, but he will not set foot on a baseball diamond during this season. I think we can all agree on that. It's just, what hook do you hang that on and how do you justify it? I think Major League Baseball is going to basically await for the completion of this evidentiary hearing, and then they'll have all that they need, especially if he testifies.
I think the administrative leave was agreed to continue to Friday, August 20th. And I believe unless that the judge reserves ruling, which means that she hasn't decided one way or another on it. I think we'll have a ruling on Thursday, and the MLB will have the answer whether or not they can suspend him right then and there on Friday.
Sure. It's an emergency proceeding. TRO rulings and domestic violence are not like, you know, waiting for a motion for summary judgment in one of the civil cases that you and I might work on in the Florida, you know, Miami-Dade County Circuit Court. This calls for an urgent and immediate ruling. So I would expect within a week following the conclusion of the hearing that the judge will at least enter some kind of ruling, whether it's reduced to writing or not, I don't know. But I would expect there to be some expedited ruling here, given the nature of the allegations and the type of summary proceeding that this is.
Agreed.
You know, I think it's a good breaking point. Matt, the other reason we wanted to have you on here, probably, you know, just as big of a case, the National Football League is dealing with its own pseudo PR crisis with Deshaun Watson. Now, similar to Trevor Bauer, no criminal charges filed, and maybe a little bit different than Bauer. There's obviously some civil cases that are filed. So here's my first question to you. This was, you know, for better or for worse, I think a smart move if you're trying to apply pressure and you're the accuser in the Bauer case. You didn't have to wait for a DA to bring charges. You were able to start the wheels of justice on your own by filing a temporary order of protection or permanent order of protection. Now, why wasn't that done in the Deshaun Watson case? And can it still be done by these 20 some odd accusers?
It depends. I think it's possible that they could do it. But at the same time, I think they're awaiting something big. I think I read some article somewhere, I think it was Mark Berman, Fox 25, Harris County, was saying about how they're convening a grand jury. A grand jury being convened, allegedly, is that for Deshaun Watson means that he's likely facing felony charges. In the state of Texas, all felonies must be charged via grand jury unless the defendant waives it. The Harris County DA's office is like, hey, Deshaun, we want to charge you with X felony. Do you consent to this? He's of course not going to consent to that because he could be looking at years in prison. So I think that the alleged victims probably getting out in front of it, that ability gives the Harris County district attorneys to find out some of the facts to figure out what he actually did. The difference between Bauer and Watson, in my opinion, is we really don't know what Watson allegedly even did. We have like some idea. We're talking about he had a massage therapist and he was allegedly turning over and stuff like that. But I haven't really heard, okay, this is where the sexual assault occurs, allegedly. This is where the prostitution potentially. And that's the difference. We've heard, all right, Bauer, like, okay, these facts, this charge could fit, or based on these facts, this charge fit. We still don't know that with Watson. And I don't know if we're actually going to know that until the grand jury that has allegedly been convened returns either a true bill or no true bill.
Is there anything unique about the Texas grand jury system? I remember reading that this is not a grand jury that is specifically impaneled to hear testimony only with respect to Deshaun Watson, that this is almost like a broader or general grand jury system in which every case gets presented. So what, if anything, can we read into the presentation before this particular grand jury and what that might even mean, if anything?
Well, it's unique in that they have 12 people from Harris County, some of which might actually be Texans fans. And to return a true bill, they only need 9 people. In grand jury proceedings, which you all know, is those are secret and you could admit any and all evidence. The defendant's not there. The defendant doesn't have an attorney there. You can hear hearsay that might be deemed inadmissible later. But the reason you're able to do it now is because a judge hasn't made that ruling. And so is there sufficient evidence for this case to proceed? For example, in the state of Florida, we only have to do indictments on first-degree murder charges. Everything else can be charged by what's called an information, which is just a charging document that lays out what the charges are. Texas is different. Any and all felonies have to be charged by a grand jury. I think I just read something that Texas passed a law that makes paying for sex a felony. Had this law been active a year ago or 2 years ago, and allegedly what he was doing possibly was he was soliciting the massage therapist for sex, that would have been a felony in itself. And if he did that 22 times, that's 22 felonies. But somewhat, thankfully for him, he did this long before this became a law. So I think to answer your question, that if you only need 9 of 12 people, and that all felonies itself have to be used by a grand jury to be able to charge him with a felony, which is unique in and of itself. I had never seen that before.
I don't want to gloss over it. Us three probably know this well, the expression, right? A grand jury can even indict a ham sandwich. And for all the reasons, Pat, that you've laid out, anything and everything is admissible. So for those that are listening to this podcast that are not lawyers, law students, you know, have no relation to this, if there is a grand jury that is convened for Deshaun Watson, what percentage chances would you put that they come away with some type of charge for Deshaun Watson?
Probably say close to 80%, probably more. Because if they're convening it, they have to think that a grand jury is going to indict. Usually in grand jury proceedings, if you bring the case and a no bill is returned, in some cases, that case is over with. I'm almost positive in the state of Massachusetts, you bring a grand jury and they say no bill, that's done. The case can never be charged. Think double jeopardy. So if they're allegedly bringing this case, I think they feel fairly confident, if not very confident, that they could walk away with an indictment or indictments.
You know, Matt, we brought you in for the criminal side of this. Now, I can tell you, if this was just a civil sexual assault case, and there's just one case, this could take anywhere from beginning to end without some type of settlement. A year and a half, 2.5 years is not a crazy time frame, especially in the COVID world that we live in. Now, when you add 20 different people and you have to extend depositions out, I don't know, bump that back maybe a couple months now. And you have 20 different trials, bump that back a couple more months. So not a crazy world where from beginning to end, this would take 3 years. And I don't think that's a crazy amount of time to put in this with 20 different accusers, 20 different additional depositions, that much more moving parts and all this fun stuff. Now, do I think some cases are going to get settled? Sure. From a time frame perspective, this is the part I wanted to kind of ask you about. All of those mechanisms I just described with the discovery schedule and motion practice and the civil trial, all of that comes to a screeching halt if and when there are criminal charges. So Matt, I turn it to you. From a criminal perspective, right, we know in our court system, criminal cases will take precedence over a civil case relating out of the same common nucleus. O.J. Simpson case taught us that. What do you think we're looking at from beginning to end if there are potentially 20 different counts of assault for Watson? What would that take time-wise?
So there could be two separate ways the prosecution, if it's actually charged, could go with it. One, they could try them one at a time and be like, all right, here's our best one. Let's start there. If we convict him of that, and if it's some felony, he might plead to the rest for concurrent sentences. So we don't have to drag them all in. I think it's unlikely they obviously would have to. He has a constitutional right to be tried on each and every one of the charges. So if he had 22 separate trials, we could be 5 years. It's more likely that we're on an 18-month to two-year timeline, I would say, given the complexity of the case, giving the number of alleged accusers. It could be only one. That grand jury could only be one of those cases, or it could be all 22. We don't know. But I think that we're on an 18-month to 24-month timeline, unless he demands a speedy trial or they try to push it along as quickly as possible. But I think we're 18 months to 2 years.
I guess we'll finish with this. I mean, Dan and I handle the civil side of this. You handle the criminal side. I think a real estimate of these cases being resolved absent some type of settlement, 5 years is not a crazy. If you put the over under it at 3.5 years, I'd probably take the over for both criminal and civil to get adjudicated. So as the football fan in me, and I could be wrong, I would find it very odd that a team would sign up for this headache for the next 3 to 5 years unless they're getting absolute pennies on the dollar from the Houston Texans. I keep hearing reports that the Philadelphia Eagles are interested, which I don't really contest. Of course, they'd be interested, but the price has to be right. And I keep hearing this price being both sky high, which doesn't make sense to me. But listen, this is why you guys turn into the legal podcast, because we're telling you, this thing is going to hang over his head for a while. And guys, if it doesn't hang over his head, that means that he's probably accepted, right, a plea of guilty, and he's accepted some type of resolution on the civil cases, which still would allow for some type of suspension. So I've never thought this was a squeaky clean exit for Deshaun. So Matt, let me ask you this as we're getting you out of here. Any parting thoughts on the Bauer case or Watson case that we did not get to?
Everything I've been reading about Bauer, I think they're asking the wrong questions. It's not whether it was consensual or not. It's whether she lost that ability to consent. It's whether he knew she was unconscious. That's the real issue. Because if he knew she was unconscious, allegedly during this alleged incident, then I think he would probably face a conviction. And it wouldn't matter what the text messages said. It wouldn't matter whether she liked it or not. She couldn't consent to it either way. So you can read that article. It should be coming out in the next day or so on conduct detrimental. as to Watson, when I saw human trafficking was running it, I'm not saying that's what Deshaun Watson was doing, because human trafficking usually oversees solicitation of prostitution. It oversees some kind of domestic cases. I wouldn't be shocked if they're the ones running it that Deshaun was paying for sex. I don't know that for a fact. I want to wait for the indictment if they come down, but I think it was something in the realm of solicitation and or possibly sexual assault.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us. You've done an excellent job. Us over here at Conic Detrimental, we love your article titles too. They're very lawyerly, as we'll say. But Matt, thank you so much for joining us. Congrats on your first radio gig. I saw over the weekend with Sports Map Radio, friend of the show, Fred Davis. Keep up the good work, my friend.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me on.
Thank you, Matt.
So Dan, that was Matt, our first contributor coming on to onto the show. What'd you think?
Are we contributors? We're like 100-time guests. But this story, come on, the story of Deshaun Watson and Trevor Bauer, I mean, it really underscores why we've used the name Conduct Detrimental for a sports law podcast. This is sort of right in the wheelhouse of the kind of stories that led us to start this podcast. Tom Brady, the Adrian Peterson, the cases that explore the boundaries of professional sports disciplinary proceedings with the additional overlay of potential criminal proceedings. So perfect exploration for Conduct Detrimental.
Dan, let's do this. What to watch for? I'll give you mine and then I'll send it to you. We recorded an episode in our archive. It's very funny. I can see the statistics on when our older episodes are being viewed. Our Barstool NIL episode to this day, still getting a ton of downloads. So people are interested in this question. The news as of late, if you were not following social media, Dan and I did a whole podcast when a Division II school called AIC basically banned athletes from working with Barstool. I don't know if anybody necessarily cares about AIC. I'll tell you a school they do care about. The Louisville Cardinals, Division I basketball blue blood, just came out and said exactly, or essentially the same thing. We do not want our athletes working with Barstool. They haven't provided the reasoning, but it's a good indication that it's either gambling, alcohol, or some combination of the two. A Division I program, Dan, and their school is kind of in my replies, kind of commending Louisville on taking that really big step. It might hurt their recruiting prospects, but they say it's violative of Kentucky law, and they're not going to let it fly. So my what to watch for is how other schools, other Division I programs deal with this Barstool problem. 150,000 athletes have registered to be a Barstool athlete. And this is a large market share that could be affected by a potential school rules changer.
Well, I think it kind of depends on the state and the debate surrounding Barstool and whether or not it's a gambling company. I think now that same conversation could very well be had with Fanatics.
Right.
Fanatics, and this ties into some of the news of the past week or two. Fanatics is part of a bidding consortium for New York online sports betting. Governor Cuomo, signed into law a sports betting law that created competitive bidding to have the right to offer online sports betting in New York. So the bids were due a week and a half ago, and one of the six bidding groups was Barstool's parent company, Penn National Gaming, joining forces with Fanatics to be one of the groups that would be, given the right to offer online sports betting in New York. Now, the results of the bidding and who's selected, we won't know that until December at the earliest, but it is very interesting that Barstool and Fanatics are joining forces. And what makes them particularly compelling as a sports betting company isn't their experience necessarily, because you can hire, vendors and you could ramp up a sports betting infrastructure. What they bring to the table, just like DraftKings or FanDuel, is their enormous customer base. Fanatics has an advantage. I think there was an article that I read in Front Office Sports that referred to it as its secret sports betting weapon, a database of 80 million customers who buy apparel that can be converted potentially into sports betting customers for little or no acquisition cost. So for the same reasons that Barstool could become a sports betting powerhouse through its affiliation with Penn National, their enormous sports user base, Fanatics is also going to be joining or is attempting to join the sports betting industry as an operator. And they formed a company called Fanatics Betting and Gaming. And guess who the vice chairman of the company is?
Ova.
Who?
We're saying the same thing.
Okay. Jay-Z is the vice chairman and a member of the board of directors of Fanatics Betting and Gaming. So we're now beginning to see sort of the convergence of sports, gaming, and entertainment manifested in a company like Fanatics becoming a sports betting company, or at least rolling out a sports betting division. They hired the former president and CEO of FanDuel to run its sports betting operation, and they are going to be a force to be reckoned with in the sports betting industry. And their first target, you know, is the New York online sports betting requests for proposals. And they could very well be one of the companies that gets to operate online sports betting in New York State as early as the Super Bowl.
Dan Hova is one of Jay-Z's other names, but listen,
you're talking to somebody who is over, you know, Bruce Springsteen is my wheelhouse. Yeah. The Who, the Beatles, you're gonna run Hova by me? That is way too obscure for a 59-year-old person living in Siberia. You got to come with a little bit more obvious of a reference. 99 problems? You're going to run Hova with me?
99
Hova?
Problems, but then Novosibirsk ain't one for you. I thought, Dan, what you were going to say, which maybe we'll save for a different show. News, obviously, you grew up in New York. I'm in New York now. The resignation of Governor Cuomo might have some impact on sports betting, but we'll save it for another time. But Dan, my one thing, I want to make sure we hit it. People have been commenting on this legal life advice section. I'm not going to mention anyone by name, but just as a quick legal life advice, a law student reached out to me, we'll say 2 months ago, and he had a really interesting decision he was weighing. I'm not going to say the names, don't worry. But he was weighing, should he take a job as an NIL coordinator for one of these really big agencies? Or, you know, he had a job lined up with one of these big white shoe firms. Again, I'm not going to say the name. And there was a world where he could have done, you know, the NIL stuff for a couple months, you know, leading into his 3L year, or I just was going to say, you know what, I'm going to go the corporate route. So I said, there's no wrong answer, right? You have a job lined up with a corporate firm. Maybe you want to play in the NIL waters for a couple months, but he was really hung up on this decision and the decision he came to, which I thought was very interesting. I told him do both, you know me, Dan, I say yes to everything. And, you know, I'll figure out where the time comes later. I used to have a friend in college. His first name is Mike, if he's listening, but he used to say, sleep when you're dead. And he used to load himself up with everything and anything. And then, you know, he slept, I guess, when he was dead.
Warren Zevon said that, by the way.
Who said that?
Warren Zevon. I'll sleep when I'm dead. It all ties back to Warren Zevon. You know, the theme of our podcast was Lawyers, Guns, and Money by Warren Zevon. So it comes full circle here in Conduct Detrimental. Listen, I don't know his story. I don't know this person's circumstances. But 99 out of 100 times at the beginning of your legal career, you're opting for a narrow niche in NIL coordinator for an agency, unless you're 100% or 99.9% sure that that's the path you want to take for the rest of your legal career. You can't necessarily jump back into corporate law, but you can always transition from a white shoe law firm job, or even any kind of like prominent law firm. You can pivot into a lot of different positions throughout different industries. What's the rush? What's the hurry? Let's see this shake out. You could bring in NIL work for your law firm. How about that? That's an NIL facilitator for your law firm. So I think the platform of being in a law firm and sharpening your skills and developing your skill set, a lawyer, your analytical ability, your writing, your client development skills, a lot of those skill sets are going to prove invaluable for years and decades to come. You may not get that kind of experience and training in a private industry position where you've had no prior law firm experience. So I think from the get-go, I think sometimes it's smart to play it a little safer, to build up your credentials and get exposed to different types of practice areas and practice groups and different companies. I didn't know I was going to get into sports betting or sports gambling. It took me 30 years to get there. If you had asked me, what was my ideal dream job position before law school? I guarantee you I would have made the wrong choice.
I'm with you, Dan. And I think to your point, he didn't hear our podcast before, but he said, you know what? I'm going to go corporate and I'm going to take my 3L year. I'm going to relax. I'm going to go hit the ground running when I get to corporate law. And then Dan, as we know, David Stern, Adam Silver, there's a lot of people that pass through these big firms and end up, you know, with really high positions in sports. So can't hurt. It's a good decision to have. So
Bettman, Silver, Stern, Manfred, not everybody becomes the commissioner of a sports league.
Oh, wait, you forgot one. Wallach.
Goodell, no. Wallach, no. Wallach became an attorney, but Adam Silver was an associate. I think it was at Cravath, Swain, and Moore. So those are the sort of the uber success stories, you know, in the industry. But there are many, many people who found a pathway into the sports industry through law firm practice and then transitioning and maybe going to work with one of their clients or going in-house. It happens. But I think at the beginning of your career, to take a wild leap of faith in a new industry like that, you should really, really be certain and do your due diligence before making a decision like that.
So Dan, let us put this in the books, I guess, as a final note. If you guys didn't see it, Dan, I know you messaged me about it. My documentary debut, Fight for Football. It's the story of how the Big Ten football season was saved. Nebraska plays a role. For another time, we'll talk about it when the release comes out. Dan, anything else to add before we put this episode officially in the books?
No, I'm not in any documentaries this week, but hope springs eternal.
Okay, well, Dan Wallach, as always, is at Wallach Legal. You're making me laugh this episode, Dan. You're on your game. Myself, Dan Lust at Sports All Lust, the show at Con Detrimental. And yeah, big shout out to Themis, as always. And yeah, we will see you next week on another episode of Con Detrimental.